Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Although we finished the main content of the Cold War Coastal Command series in the last chapter, a story emerged that we just couldn't resist. Stephen Bridgewater, deputy editor for Aerospace Magazine and good friend of the show, mentioned that he had in fact purchased an RAF Nimrod directly from the RAF back in 2010. After Steve's story, Gareth joins the feature as he was there the day 232 arrived in Coventry. Steve, welcome back to Extended.
Hi, Peter. Good to see you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, we met up recently at the Aerospace Media Awards, and you told me a story I couldn't let go. Wasn't originally part of the plan for this series, but thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us about your little catch. So just before we talk about the Nimrod, Steve, how did you get involved in that part of the world and get in a position where you got involved with the airframe?
Well, I went to university in Coventry, and having grown up around aeroplanes, been an aviation enthusiast all my life, I volunteered my time to Air Atlantique at Coventry Airport. They were doing hangar tours at the time at what was then called the Air Atlantique Historic Flight, or the Hysteric Flight, as we christened it. So I would give up my Sundays and go and show people around the hangar, which was just great, great fun. Made lots of connections, lots of contacts there. That was not long after we'd taken delivery of the Shackletons, actually.
Okay.
One of which ultimately went out to Pima, and one, as you know, is currently on the move from Coventry.
Yeah.
So I spent quite a long time doing that. Even when I left university and went into work, I would go at weekends and do some voluntary work, and then became an aviation journalist, and that takes up all your time. So I kind of drifted away from Air Atlantique, and then many years later, I was having a bit of I wanted to do something different from writing for a while, so I took a little bit of a sabbatical. And Air Atlantique, as was then the Classic Flight, as it had been rebranded, was looking for somebody to run their members group, the Classic Flight Club. So I joined to do that, and ultimately ended up as commercial director for Air Atlantique Classic Flight.
Okay.
So I always tell people it's an example of where volunteering leads. You know, you go in at 18, 19 years old as a volunteer, and you know, then when you're in your 30s, you know, people remember who you are. And,
you know,
I think it's just a great example of sort of that way that aviation links and goes through your entire career.
Yeah, and what does a commercial director do for an organisation like Air Atlantique?
Pretty good idea. Air Atlantique was a I don't say a funny organisation, because that's not right. It was a small business. Probably, if I give you a bit of context as to where it came from, it might make a little bit more sense. So Air Atlantique formed in the late 70s by Mike Collett. And Mike was based in Jersey, and he set up a business where he would fly flowers from Jersey to the mainland, and then he would fly the newspapers from the mainland down to Jersey. And from there, he grew into having quite a ever-growing size of airline.
Okay.
And most people remember Air Atlantique for the fleet of Dakotas, the DC-3s.
Yeah.
The airline grew over the years into having lots of different arms. So we had Atlantic Air Transport or Atlantic Cargo. So they had the DC-6s and the Lockheed Electras and the DC-3s. So they would do ad hoc freight work. And there was being in Coventry, a lot of that was down to the motor industry. So Peugeot were based in Coventry.
Yeah.
And they would fly parts back and forth. And it developed a reputation for being a very flexible airline. So if you needed something moving quickly, that was what we would do. And also, at the time, we were one of the only airlines that had a dangerous goods license. So we would fly ejector seat cartridges and things like that.
Right.
Having the fleet of Dakotas, you need a certain type of person to fly a Dakota, you know, a tailwheel pilot, multi-engine tailwheel pilot. We couldn't necessarily get people straight out of commercial flying school. So Mike set up his own flying school. So Atlantic Flight Training was born. Then there was a business opportunity where there was a reconnaissance division. So we had Atlantic Reconnaissance.
Yeah.
We had some fantastic contracts with the reconnaissance. This is when I was volunteering there. So, for example, you may know the Scottish Aviation Twin Pioneer, yeah, big high-wing, very, very slow aeroplane.
Yeah.
We had a contract with the East Midlands Electricity Board. So we would fly this aeroplane with heat-sensing cameras on board, looking at people's attics, and then the East Midlands Electricity Board would go around and try and sell them loft insulation because it's warm.
Yeah, okay, right.
So there's lots of little things like that that happened. And so the airline grew during that time. And while it was making lots and lots of money, Mike Collett, because he was an aviation enthusiast as much as you and I, was collecting vintage aeroplanes. So we started off with things like Dragon Rapide, which we put into service for pleasure flying. But then we got a Vampire and we got a Meteor and there was a Percival Pembroke and that's why the Shackletons came on the fleet at one time.
Right, yeah.
So we had all of these. Mike then retired. He sold off all of the bits of the business. So Atlantic Reconnaissance, Atlantic Flight Training were also, and a lot of them were management buyouts. He sold them to the people who were running the businesses for him.
Yeah.
So by the time I came into the Classic Flight, we had the vintage aeroplanes left. So we'd gone from being a very profitable airline that had a little sideline of having vintage aeroplanes to being a collection of vintage aeroplanes that was losing money hand over fist. So my job and the rest of the team that were there was to try and make the collection pay for itself. Not make a profit. We just didn't want to keep having to go to the chairman and asking for as much money as we did the month before.
Yeah.
So in answer to your question on what a commercial director did, I was looking at the air show bookings, trying to get the aircraft out to different air shows. So by that time, we'd got two Venoms, Vampire, the second Meteor came online while I was there, so the Meteor T7, and the Pembroke, and the Prentice, and the Proctor, and all this get collected. Mike's collecting policy was, he said to me once, we would never have a Spitfire. He said, because everybody else is saving Spitfires. He wanted to save the aeroplanes that had an important story to tell, but for want of a phrase, they weren't sexy. They weren't the ones that people wanted to preserve, so, which is why we had Apprentice, which was an awful aeroplane, but it had still got a story to tell. You know, and if you know the story of the Apprentice, you know, it's a 5-seat basic trainer for the Royal Air Force. You know, it was so the theory was you would have a pilot and an instructor, a student and an instructor in the front. Then you'd have other students in the back leaning over the shoulders, learning from the mistakes of the guy in front. It was a big, heavy aeroplane. So we preserved things like that. So commercial director point of view, it was getting the air show bookings in, looking after our merchandise, keeping our Classic Flight Club members happy. So a very varied role. But as is always the way with this, there was lots of mission creep. So we ended up setting up the museum at Coventry and then ultimately moving everything down to Newquay when we relocated down from airbase at Coventry down to the Classic Flight down at what was RAF Newquay. So so that's how I became involved in the Nimrod story, really.
Okay, so let's talk about the Nimrod. How the heck did a Nimrod then end up in that eclectic mix?
It was a chance phone call, in all honesty. I got a phone call from Steve Slade, who I've known from. So Steve is a member of the British Disabled Flying Association. He flies a RANS S6. I think he's actually still retains the record for the number of touch and goes in an hour. Just went round and round and round and round in circles, touching the wheels every sort of 20 seconds. So I've known Steve for many, many years. And he phoned me at my desk at Coventry and said, because he worked for Rolls-Royce, and he'd heard on the grapevine that one of the Nimrods that were being offered out to museums, the deal had fallen through and this aircraft was available. So we now know that one went to Bruntingthorpe, one went to Elvington, one went to East Midlands, Cosford had one, which obviously got roaded into Cosford from, I think they landed it at Shawbury. took it to pieces and then put it in. And he said, you know, would you be interested in having a Nimrod as part of the collection at Air Atlantique? And initially, I thought the answer would be no, because what set us apart from other museums is that everything that we operated flew. So we were kind of like a 1950s equivalent of the Shuttleworth collection, if you like, in that we had vintage vehicles and vintage aircraft, but they all flew. And our sort of tagline and what Mike Collett used to say is that we're not an aeroplane museum. He said, we are the equivalent. If an aeroplane museum was a zoo, we would be the equivalent of a safari park in our aircraft roam and fly and do
whatever.
Yeah. So initially I thought, yeah, the option of having a static Nimrod would not really appeal. So I said to Mike, I'd get back to him, and went, spoke to Mike Collett, and, we had a discussion over a cup of coffee that, well, you know, we've got lots of de Havilland aeroplanes. And of course the Nimrod has its heritage in the Comet. And although we wouldn't be able to fly the aeroplane, perhaps we would be able to keep it alive. We'd be able to taxi it. So the Shackleton at the time we had was running engines. Yep. So I was tasked with going in and seeing if I could negotiate and find out what the deal was. And so I set about phoning Kinloss, as you do, and miraculously got through to the station commander. I don't, still to this day, don't know how I managed to do that, but to the gal, maybe.
Interesting, interesting. Probably wouldn't be able to do it today.
No, this was 2010, so 14 years ago now. So that's exactly what I did. I phoned Kinloss and got through to him with his base commander at the time, and explained who we were and what we were looking for. And he was very much in favour of us having the aeroplane. Again, he realised that of all the people that were operating them, it was probably going to be Elvington, Bruntingthorpe and ourselves that would be able to keep one running.
Yeah.
And in his eyes, that was essential for remembering the crews that had flown on the Nimrod and been lost on the Nimrod, of course, you know, in many occasions. So he was very much in favour, said he would give it his full backing. However, the decision didn't lie with him. It lay with something called Defence Disposals Agency, which are were based down at Bicester at the time. I'm not sure if they're still there. So he gave me a phone number to phone Defence Disposals Agency. And they're the people that were charged, if you like, for want of a phrase, for getting their pound of flesh. So they even though Kinloss wanted us to have the aeroplane, it had to go through the disposals agency to make sure that the fair price was paid for it. And it couldn't just be given away. So I phoned Defence Disposals Agency, had a very interesting phone call. Chap at the end of the phone, very helpful, said, yep, we'd love you to have the aeroplane. Here's the deal. We need you to make an offer that is the equivalent as to what the scrap value is of the aeroplane. So if you can basically pay us more than the scrap man, we're happy for you to have the aeroplane.
And so, Steve, was that because nobody else wanted it, or was that just the process?
That was the process. I think there was a lot of give in the system, in that they both, the base commander at Kinloss and the Defence Disposals, knew that we would be a good home for the aeroplane. So I think they had to dot the I's and cross the T's and prove to the Treasury that, you know, we couldn't have scrapped it for more value than we've given it to these guys.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the bench line that was set. So I thought I'd chance my arm and say, well, I don't mean to be funny, but can you tell me what the scrap value of the Nimrod is?
Who would know?
It's a big lump of metal, isn't it? I've never bought anything like that before. So the chap on the end of the phone said, well, I would estimate it's somewhere in the region of £15,000. So I said, what, 50,000? 50? He went, no, 15. So I thought, that's cheap. That's a lot of aeroplane for £15,000. It's not going to buy you a Piper Cub, is it? So I thought that's interesting. So when had lunch with the chairman, Mike, and explained the conversations that I'd been having that morning, and Mike said, well, what do you want to do, Steve? So I said, well, I think we should put an offer in. Yeah, you never go straight in with the purchase price, do you? It's like buying the car, you always make an offer and you haggle and you come to a deal somewhere between the two. So I faxed my offer across to Defence because it's in the days when people were still using fax machines.
Yeah, so for those youngsters, that's a bit of paper you feed into a machine, into a photocopier that comes out the other end.
Magic. So I faxed the offer across and heard nothing more. So I thought, I've kind of spoiled it here. Maybe I put an offer in that was a bit too low and I've insulted them. So we heard nothing. And then about, 2-3 months later, I had a phone call from a squadron leader, Roxy Roxburgh, who incidentally is now a friend of mine on Facebook. We managed to connect fairly recently. And Roxy said, hi, Steve. I'm delivering your Nimrod next week. I'm just wondering what time you would like it.
Wow.
So I explained that we'd still not done a deal to buy the aeroplane. So he suggested that we flew up and up to Kinloss and had lunch and had a chat about it and a tour around the flight line and all the good stuff like that. So my good friend Trevor Bailey, the late much missed Trev, and I flew up to Kinloss about 2 days later and had lunch and mess.
What was that like, Steve? What was that like flying into Kinloss? Because obviously operational station. I'm assuming you went up in one of your aircraft.
We took the Dove up there. The Dove. It was great. Trev was in the right-hand seat. We took one of our cadet pilots up to do the flying.
Yeah.
So, again, back to where we talked about the Atlantic flight training element of what we did with our flying school. Back in the good old days, pre-9/11, we would hire cadet pilots and they would be bonded to the company. So we would pay for their private pilot's license, their commercial pilot's license, their tailwheel rating, and they were bonded to work for the company for 4 or 5 years, whatever it was. They were colloquially known as fugglies within the scheme. So we still had a number of these people on in 2010. Who were not through the same part of the scheme, but they were still, we were giving them the sort of the foot on the ladder, if you like, particularly when it came into flying vintage aeroplanes.
Okay.
So I can't remember who it was, but it was one of our fugglies that flew us up there. By that time, Kinloss was really quiet. They were at the point of winding down the Nimrod fleet. They were all parked. I remember arriving in the overhead and they were all parked out. Really, it was quite a sad sight. They were still flying, but it was really just to keep them operational, ready to be delivered to their ultimate homes.
I
remember we got a tour around. There was a Nimrod on the gate at Kinloss, which I think ultimately moved to Moravia or one of the collections. I don't think it's at Kinloss anymore. So we had a look around inside as to what the state of the aeroplane would be like, if you like, once it was preserved. Because Nimrods, even in the latter years, were used for some fairly sensitive missions.
They're selling you a Nimrod. They were selling you a Nimrod with all that kit in it as well.
Wow, thereby hangs the rub. You see,
inside
any of the operational aeroplanes because they put those things on. So we looked around. I can't remember the registration of the aeroplane, but it was the one that's now at Moravia. Had a look inside that. And there were a number of screens and things that had been removed, which was fine from our point of view. We'd actually got in mind that where the screens had been removed, we could actually put LCD screens in and actually have it with video running or some sort of educational games or something that when we were doing STEM activities, we could get kids on the aeroplane. So that didn't bother us at all. So the next thing was to go and have lunch in the mess and talk about the deal that had yet been done. So we sat down and had one of those. I mean, we're 14 years down the line now, so I can probably say plausible deniability conversations, where it was decided that the aeroplane would fly into us the following week. Now, you have to remember in the context here, this is 2010. We were still at that point getting Nimrod MRA-4. So there were a number of bits that were going to be scavenged off the MR2 fleet to go into MRA. For example, they were even taking the windscreen wipers off.
Right. Know, okay.
To the element, yeah, to the amount of bean counting that was going on. So
yeah,
it was said, look, we'll fly the airplane down to you next week. We arrive on Tuesday. We will retain ownership of the airplane until Friday, by which time we've taken off all the bits that we want to put onto MRA4. On Friday afternoon, we will give you the keys to your aeroplane and the tech logs, at which point it will not be flyable. If you've still not done a deal, well, possession's 9/10 of the law. Nobody's going to come and fly it away, are they? So I sort of put my teeth and thought, well, if you're sure. And that was the basis we worked on.
Wow.
So sure enough, oh, that would have been, I think that was about the Monday, and the following Tuesday, the aeroplane flew down. So it was done. It was a very, very quick, having sat around twiddling our thumbs for months waiting for a deal. The final deal, in inverted commas, was done very quickly. And we were given the choice of aeroplane, you know, which one would we like? And they suggested to us that XV-232 would be the best option, particularly because we wanted to keep it live and taxiing. And the reason for that was twofold. One, it was a very historic aeroplane. XV-232 was the aeroplane that was mounted with Sidewinder missiles during the Falklands.
Yeah.
It also was the aeroplane which had the record at the time for the longest ever Royal Air Force mission. Again, during the Falklands, it was flying up and down the Argentine coast, keeping the fleet in harbour.
Yeah.
It's interesting, if you look at the logbooks for this, the day after that very, very long mission was when they fitted the Sidewinder missiles to the aeroplane. And you kind of get the impression that they came back after this very long mission and said, we're not going back until you give us something to defend ourselves.
Yeah.
It really was the following day that the missiles were put on the aeroplane. But the other thing that was good with us with 232 was that it had recently been through a major refurbishment. It had run off the runway at Kinloss, and the main gear, I can't remember if it's the port or the starboard main gear, had run into the mud, and it had wrenched the gear backwards. So the aeroplane had had a pretty much a major rebuild, and it only got something like 20 or 30 hours on it since it came off major rebuild. So in terms of, you know, preserving an active aeroplane, that was the, in the RAS term, that was the one we suggested. And of course, you know, with the history, we jumped at the chance.
So, how excited were you at Coventry Airport waiting for an RAF Nimrod to come into to land? What were you feeling?
It was brilliant. You know, it was we'd had a very short amount of time to get things set up. So we've got press conferences set. We've got Nimrod veterans there. At the time, Coventry Airport was actually closed because it had been, Coventry's had a very tempestuous history in terms of the history of the airfield itself. And at that point, the airfield operator had gone bust, which was bad news for a lot of people. But it was good news for us because it meant the airfield wasn't licensed. So people could wander around on the ramp. You know, we spoke to Roxy, and he was happy to do a couple of low approaches and go arounds before he landed the aeroplane, which if the airfield had been licensed, we perhaps wouldn't have been able to do. So that worked out really in our favour. But there was a big turnout for it. So this was the time when lots of the Nimrods were being delivered, and I think ours was about the last but one or the last but two to go.
So still lots of interest.
Yeah, all the aviation press turned up. A certain Gareth Stringer turned up. I remember he was there.
I'll have to pin him on that.
And, he was there. I'm sure he's got some photographs somewhere. He did an interview with me on the day about which went on Global Aviation Resource about the official version at the time, not this version of how the aeroplane came to be with us.
No, of course.
The aeroplane was actually delayed. They'd had really bad weather up in Kinloss. This was May, and they'd had, I think, a big squall had gone through. So we got everybody sitting around for about an hour waiting for news. And it was actually Trev who took the phone call to say, right, they've just got airborne. So we knew that they would be with us in about 35, 40 minutes. So we took the press outside. We'd got some cherry pickers for them to stand to get photographs as the aeroplane taxied in, and everybody sort of scanned the horizon looking for 232. And there was a big cheer when she appeared over Draycott Water. And true to form, Roxy did, I think it was 2 or 3 low approaches and go-arounds, poured the power on, and that black smoke came out the back of the aeroplanes. We'll remember the
unique sound. Yeah.
And then just wonderful. And then he brought it round, nice curved approach, and she landed for the final time. And taxied right up to in front of where my office was. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house, I have to say. It was, for me personally, it was a great sense of achievement. It was a great sense of relief that it had arrived. I'd not long lost my mother. And it was one of those things that one of the last things I'd been talking to her about was this plan to buy it now that it had come to fruition. Yeah. I think there was a little bit of moisture in my eye when she taxied in. I can assure you of that. But it was one of those great sort of testimonies that, yes, we've done it. We've made it work.
So how did when it landed, Steve, just before you finish this, how do you then ground handle something like that? Admittedly, your fleet wasn't that large in terms of aircraft types and things. How did you know how to handle it? How did you know how to switch stuff on, switch stuff off? I mean, did you get a lesson from Roxy before he left? Goodness me, what did he do? Just walk out, give you the keys and say, right, I'm off?
No, not at all. The guys from Kinloss actually came down with about 3 transit vans full of spares, tow bars. They handled it when it came in for the first time. So it was at that point, it was still a Royal Air Force aeroplane. At that point, it was all handled through their SOPs.
Yeah. And was the runway,
like I said, they've got two.
Was the runway length okay as well? Because, I mean,
runway length was absolutely fine. Yeah. Coventry was really, in its heyday, Coventry was operating 737s and fully loaded 737s full of passengers. So no issue there at all. There was a query over taxiway. There were certain taxiways that we could or couldn't use because they weren't as wide as we needed.
Yeah.
Runway length wasn't a problem at all. There was some issue as to where we were going to park the aeroplane ultimately. So, because the airfield wasn't licensed at this time, we could just leave it out on the ramp and not worry about blocking too much space. So we've got a few weeks to decide where we want to put it.
The guys
came down with transit vans full of stuff. And because they knew that we intended to keep it running, they had stuff, not just the transit vans, but also the aeroplane came down full of oil, every possible spare that they must have raided the spares store at Kinloss for anything they thought might be potentially useful.
Yeah.
So we had this fantastic stuff that we might need. And they spent 4 days demilitarizing, I guess the word would be, the aeroplane. There was one guy sat in my office for 4 days tapping away on his computer, and by about day 3 I thought, I've got to say something to him. I thought, I don't mean to be rude, but what are you doing in my office? Who are you? And he said, I'm here for explosives.
Right. Yeah.
Are there many explosives on a Nimrod? He went, dinghy and a very pistol. This chap had come down. So he was the only member of the team that was qualified for them to demilitarize the dinghy and the very pistol. And he spent the rest of the week sitting doing his Open University course in my office because he was
Now, you mentioned also the logbooks. And you mentioned, obviously, those missions in the South Atlantic. What did those logbooks look like? Did they have sensitive information in them?
No, nothing at all. There were a group of us from Air Atlantique got on the aeroplane as soon as it landed. Roxy and the crew led us on, which in hindsight, they probably shouldn't have done, because at that point, it had still got lots of the screens and equipment on that they later removed. Everything that was in the logbooks was fairly declassified. There was nothing which was of any particular threat or concern. It was really just sort of where the aeroplane had been and mission. The same as if you were doing a private pilot's license logbook. The mission times, start times, takeoff times, landing times, Occasionally, there'd be an interesting note in the notes column that this was the aircraft log in terms of its hours more than mission logs.
Yeah. So how did you then go on to utilize and support the aircraft after that? How did you crew it? How did you maintain it? Goodness me, what do you do?
Well, we luckily we'd gotten through the Shackleton Trust, who had got the Shackleton at Coventry. They had an extensive network of people who'd worked in Coastal Command, some of whom were Nimrod people. So they came on board pretty much as soon as we had the aeroplane. Really, it became their little baby. The intention was to keep the aeroplane taxiing. That never happened. It ran on a regular basis, but just logistically from where it was parked, and also the fact that with the airport going back into being licensed again, we never got it to into taxiing condition, but it did do a number of ground runs and still does ground runs now. But those Nimrod veterans trained up a number of our people from Air Atlantique, both volunteers and some of our flight crew. So it was well handled. It was well looked after. And the guys just brought a wealth of stories with them as well. The Nimrod guys would talk about some of the missions that they'd done. And I just remember being on board the cockpit when we had the local mayor of Coventry came in for some event and photo call, sitting in the left hand seat of 232, and one of the crew members was sat next to him and explained to him, got the yoke in his hand, and he said, if you flip up there are two buttons on the captain's control, one says C and one says M. He says, so if you flip up the seat, and so they've got like a guard on the switches, and flip up the C, and somebody with a biro had drawn a smiley face. And then the red one, which had N, flipped up somebody called a sad face. And the mayor said, so what does C and N stand for? And with a deathly calm expression, the guy in the right-hand seat went, conventional and nuclear, sir. And you saw the colour fade from the mayor's face.
Right.
The power of that button that he'd got under his finger.
Wow.
So sort of things that really bring it to home. That
it was a weapon platform. Absolutely.
The aeroplane had a number of potential missions and was geared up to do it.
Before I test you a little bit on the rest of your Nimrod knowledge, Steve, and let you go, and there's one other part of the story you didn't allude to, and that's the actual value of the aircraft was, if not doubled, probably even a little bit more, and that was because of the fuel that it arrived with.
It was brilliant. Basically, as well as bringing it down full of oil tanks, full of all the spare parts, they'd filled it to the gunnels with fuel before they left Kinloss as well. So it came in with something like 18 tons of fuel on board. basically, we bought a flying Bowser, unbeknownst to us. And obviously, we couldn't siphon the fuel off for the airworthy aeroplanes that we got. But it kept that aeroplane ground running for a very long time.
Yeah, and those clever enough can do the maths and realize that you probably got an awful lot of value in that fuel as well.
Well, yeah, I mean that's assuming that we'd paid £15,000 for the aeroplane, though.
That is,
and that's the crux of the matter, because as I alluded to, we'd worked on the basis that possession was 9/10 of the law, about 3 months later, I had an invoice from Defence Disposals Agency for £15,000. So I immediately phoned them up and explained that if they checked the facts that I'd sent them 6 months earlier, I'd offered them £5,000. And they said, OK, thank you very much. We'll take £5,000. So I guess what you described as an admin error somewhere in the MOD and the Treasury.
Yeah.
We bought a flying Bowser full of 18 tonnes of fuel for £5,000.
Wow.
So part of me is quite sad about that, because I think that's taxpayers' money. But part of me is quite happy that we managed to preserve the aeroplane
and keep it running.
It does make me wonder whether the people at Defence Disposals had the same good heart that the people at Kinloss had, and they wanted the aeroplane to go to a good home. So that's how I came to, as in, you have a regular listener who I know we both know called Andy Kitney. Now, Andy Kitney was there when 232 landed at Coventry, and he took a photograph of me stood in front of the aeroplane, which he captioned on social media: "Look at that double bubble fuselage and the face only a mother could love," in brackets, "and a Nimrod too."
I'll have to ask Andrew for that photo. I'll chase him up this evening. I will, and Mr. Stringer as well. So, Steve, before you go, obviously the airframe went on to ground run. It's provided a lot of STEM and entertainment activities for a lot of people. How do you look back on the Nimrod and the airframe that you bought? What's your thoughts about the Nimrod and the service it provided?
I grew up watching Nimrod's air shows. I remember seeing them, you know, right from my early years. It was one of those Cold War formative aeroplanes that I really had a soft spot for. So to play a small role in preserving one was a very warm, fuzzy feeling, shall we say. But then you start to look it more in depth at the history of the aeroplane, you know, some of the tragic losses that it suffered, and you think it is even more important that we don't let this aeroplane slip into obscurity. And that's why I'm really pleased you're doing this series, Peter, because it's these unsung heroes of aeroplanes and the crews that flew them, maintained them, operated them, and built them that don't really get the limelight that I think they should. You know, we're all happy to talk about Buccaneers and Tornadoes and fast jets. But I think the Nimrod had such a vital role. And I suspect in the years to come, we'll find out that it had an even more vital role when more information is declassified about some of the missions that it did. So I think I feel very proud to have played a small part in saving 232. I just hope that its future can be saved, because as I'm sure listeners are aware, Coventry Airport is under threat at the moment. There are plans afoot to potentially build on the site. It is still an active airfield, but only just. I won't get into the politics behind all of that, but it's a very sad situation. You know that the Shackleton is moving to Elvington. At the moment, I'm not sure what's happening with XV-232. And I would like to think that that she has a future somewhere. I'm not sure that's at Coventry.
Well, on that note, Steve, thank you so much for giving up your evening. I know you've had a pretty tough couple of weeks, and it's press week this week, so I'm going to let you go now. But before I let you go...
Been React followed by Farnborough, followed by press week.
And I'm very grateful for your time this evening. Where can we find you online before I let you go, Steve, so that people can follow you?
I'm on Twitter, although I don't tend to tweet that much, on at RAES Steve B, so Royal Aeronautical Society, RAES Steve B. I'm more active on Facebook, where I'm Stephen with a PH, Bridgewater. Yep. Bridgewater's got an E in the middle, and on LinkedIn as well. So feel free to befriend me on LinkedIn or Facebook or on Twitter.
Excellent. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Peter. It's always a pleasure.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
So, Gareth, I've just jumped off of a call with Steve. Told me the amazing story about the Nimrod, how to buy a Nimrod. And we were talking about the arrival of the aircraft. And he mentioned that you were there. And you were there interviewing him for GAR back in 2010.
Yeah, it's funny because I, at the weekend, sent you a couple of photos from that event.
Yeah.
Not realizing that you were going to speak to Steve about that self-same event. And it's funny, you know, Peter, the first thing that actually came into my mind was that we seem to go through 2 or 3 years with GAR where nearly everything we did was an aircraft like being retired.
Yeah.
And there was a period where the Royal Air Force in particular, the force really consolidated and a lot of types disappeared in a relatively short space of time. You know, you think Harrier, Tornado F3, Nimrod, you know, VC-10, TriStar, and a lot of class, real sort of Dominee, a lot of real sort of classic types disappeared from service. And I guess this was another one of those kinds of events for the MR2 anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, because we still expected the MR4 to come at that point, didn't we?
I reread the feature, and just to sort of refresh my memory, you know, a bit older now, memory's not as good as it used to be. And of course, just a few months later, we were expecting the first MRA4 to be delivered, but it was in October of that year that the options for change, I think the defense review that was one, you know, with Harrier obviously as well in the October. So that was a pretty momentous event itself a few months later. So this was one of those events that was they're always a bit double-edged, these sorts of things. It's a real privilege to be there and in close proximity to an aircraft like that, a real classic sort of type. You know, the lineage of the aircraft of course makes it a real classic as well.
Yeah.
But always a bit of sadness because, you know, that was, you know, it's the last time I'm going to see an Nimrod.
Fly.
You know, flying. And an MR2 at least. So, yeah, I didn't realize it at the time, but that was the last time I saw an Nimrod.
Yeah. And Steve said that Stuart Roxburgh did a couple of fly pasts as well. He did a little display.
I think they arrived literally, I think that according to my piece, they were due to arrive at midday. They were literally there within a minute or two of the planned time, and we got a couple of fly pasts. There were quite a lot of people there from memory.
Yeah.
And literally we were all around the pan where the aircraft was, and literally a taxi bin right in front.
Yeah.
And shut down in front of everybody. And I always thought Nimrod was a beautiful and impressive sight. And, you know, to be there for that occasion, that close was fantastic.
Yeah. So how did the article turn out? Because I haven't read it yet, actually.
You haven't read it?
No, I haven't.
About 14 years old, Peter.
I know. I'd say it's as old as me, but of course it's not. So, but we are going to put a link to it, I think, in the show notes.
It's on our old... It's on the original version of the website, which is just sat there. It doesn't all work quite as well as it used to.
Okay.
It was built before, you know, things like content management and WordPress existed. But that piece does look fine. All the pictures are there and should work. And as ever, these things were made by the people and the aircraft. And we spoke to Steve. We spoke to the crew. We got some great pictures. It was some great access. And we spoke to Trevor Bailey, who Steve might have mentioned.
Yes, he did.
Tragically passed away last year. So that was another memory that came back when I read it. And of course, there were these huge plans for Coventry for Airbase and what was going to potentially be there looking ahead, which, you know, sadly, these things don't always.
Yeah, battery factory, I think. Which is very sad. But talking about the Nimrod itself, Gareth, everyone's got a view of it. Most people have a view of, well, we should never have retired it, blah blah blah. Putting that to one side, what did you think of it as a platform? You know, you got to interact with lots of crews. It's a bit of an unsung hero. It's a bit of a Coastal Command story. It was out there on the front line day in, day out. What's your view of the Nimrod?
So I think the first thing that I always think of was that huge leap from Shackleton to Nimrod. You think it's amazing when I look back when I think back now to when I was a young aviation enthusiast, that Shackleton was still our sort of, you know, our platform, that was the job that it did, this sort of lumbering beast. What did they call it?
Was it a growler?
Ribbit in close formation or whatever it was.
Yeah, I've heard and that a few times.
I saw Nimrod at air shows. We did get Nimrod displays at air shows. They were quite often, it was a very sprightly air show performer, actually. They would often perform quite a fast pass with a steep climb up and pop flares out of the aircraft. And that was the first time I'd ever really seen that happen. I just thought it's just a stunning looking aircraft. That was probably the main thing. I never made it that far up to Scotland or down to Cornwall. Of course, when they were in service, but you saw the aircraft at air shows. And of course, come that October 2010, we talk about the Air Force, the service dwindling and consolidating. Well, of course, there was no consolidation there. We just had a massive capability gap, which really wasn't filled until Poseidon
arrived.
Arrived into service, which for an island nation is pretty scandalous.
It was. We relied on our NATO allies and some Fleet Air Arm baggers, you know, and stuff like that. It was a bit of a travesty, but there you go. We're back on track, as they say now, and hopefully we'll do something on the P8 for extended as well. I think that'll definitely be a nice follow-up.
I think overall, though, I always just think of the Mighty Hunter. It's this sort of beautiful aircraft, and you think of it out there over the waves, you know, dropping sonar buoys and all that sort of anti-submarine stuff that they
Cold
did.
War stuff.
But also, you know, yachts in trouble, ships in trouble.
Yeah. That's Nimrod how I remember always, it, yeah.
Yeah, Nimrod would always be on the scene, whether it was, you know, north, south, east, west, it didn't matter. Nimrod would be there, and such an important job for the, you know, civilian job, if you like, as well as a military.
A
military role. A great type.
Well, sad to see the end of the Nimrod and the end of this series. So thanks, Gareth, for joining us and wrapping it up.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed that end to the series. Please do let us have your feedback. Leave us a review on your podcast playing app, or you can engage with us across most social media platforms. We really would like to hear what you think about the programme, so please do help us out. Thank you for joining us on the Cold War Coastal Command story, and stay tuned to this frequency. This is your aerospace radio station, Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.